Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Caring for People During COVID-19 conference call. I would like to introduce Brenda Gillette, CEO of BCCO Network. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everybody. I understand there's more than 400 people on this call. Very different experience for me. I'm used to being able to see all of your faces. And so being behind a phone and in my dining room seems a little strange. I just want to start by thanking all of you. I hear from so many of you every day, and I understand how challenging the situation is and how much very hard work is being done out there. So please take that to heart. Connect with each other when you can. I hope this call helps in some ways to provide some support for all of you. I want to start by acknowledging with gratitude that the lands from which we're calling in from today are Indigenous traditional territories. We have a number of speakers today on the line with me. We're in the quote-unquote speaker's room, although we can't see each other either. We have Minister Shane Simpson, Dr. Danielle Bain-Smith, Ross Chilton, the CEO from Community Living. We have three service providers who will speak a little bit later on, Richard Fauché from the Burnaby Association for Community Inclusion, Ellen Tarshis from Community Living Victoria, and Julie Younger from the Chilliwack Society for Community Living. We also may or may not hear from Gentile. He was going to try to join us but hadn't yet been able to do so. I want to start by opening this now for Minister Simpson, who will speak to us all. I'm limiting remarks to somewhere between 3 and 5 minutes, so I'll be watching my clock. I won't cut you off entirely, Mr. Simpson, but I just think we'll need to stick to our time schedule, or we won't be able to get through the questions and the answers that were submitted over the last day or two. So with that, welcome, Minister Simpson. We're so pleased to have you here, and I'll wait for you to go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you to everybody who's on the call. I do want to acknowledge that I'm here in my home in the traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, and I know all of you around the province are in the respective territories of your nations, and to thank them for the opportunities that we have to live and work in this place. I want to start really by thanking all of you for the work that you do every day, but especially the work you're doing in this most extraordinary and challenging time that we're in right now. We know it's a time where people's anxiousness is high, where people are scared across the population, and even more so in some of our more vulnerable communities and with the people that you work with every day. We need to be able to support people and be able to let them know that support is coming. It's an ever-evolving situation. We're working with the federal government. The federal government is making changes to their supports. It's affecting our supports. We've announced a number of things. There will be more announcements next week, including from my ministry about support for people who are directly supported from the ministry. We're also the support that we're providing to CLBC as we move forward. That support's coming from, as you know, we made a $5 billion commitment on Monday of new money. About $2.8 billion will be going directly to people and services, including services that you're delivering. In addition to that, the Solicitor General, the Public Safety Minister, announced emergency initiatives that are being put forward by the government, including essential services and the need to support those services, including the services that you're providing in communities. We know that means delivering those services. It means some adaptation. It means following the rules and the directions set down by the provincial health officer and Dr. Ben Smith. We'll talk more to that in a couple of minutes. And I want to thank her for all the support her and everybody in Dr. Bonnie Henry's shop has been to help us to do the work we're doing. We are funding the agencies. That funding will continue to support the agencies. We want you to stay as whole as possible. We want your staff to stay on the job and stay working, but we want to make sure we do that in a way that is safe, both for your staff and for the people that they work with moving forward. I know there's a lot of information to take in, so again, we'll get to the questions and we'll see where we go from there, but I just want to assure you that that we're committed and working closely with Michael Prince and with Ross and with all of CLBC to work with you to make sure that we get through this in a way that is as successful as it can be in a difficult and challenging time. And thanks again for everything you're doing, and thanks for your support to make this work as we move forward over the coming months. I think I'm just going to stop there, and we'll get on to the other matters in the agenda.
Thank you, Minister Simpson. Before I introduce Dr. Bain-Smith, I just want to remind everybody, in case you're busily scribbling notes, the call is being recorded. It will be available on the CLBC website in a day or two. We also will make arrangements, I believe, to share it. They will share it with us, and we will be able to put it on the BC CEO website as well. So please don't feel that you have to take copious notes. Dr. Danielle Bain-Smith is on the line. She's been a really great resource for us during some of our calls over the last 2 weeks and has shared information. So I'm going to introduce her. And Danielle, you've got like 5 minutes as well.
Okay, thank you so much, Brenda. Can you hear me okay? The audio's all right?
Yes.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. My name is Danielle Bain-Smith, and I'm the Deputy Provincial Health Officer for Indigenous Health. I'm really pleased to be with you on the call this morning and want to acknowledge my gratitude to the Lekwungen peoples of the Songhees and Esquimalt Nations as I work, live, and play on their territories, and I'm calling in from my home in Victoria this morning. In my opening remarks, I just wanted to very quickly touch on a couple of things. One is just to briefly review the virus and the spread of the virus, talk a little bit about the epidemiology, and think through or share with you again the rationale between our population health goals and recommendations. And then also just speak very briefly to some issues around ethical considerations and some of the work that's happening right now around things such as PPE. So just going back to the beginning and thinking about COVID-19 and the SARS-CoV-2 virus that is responsible for that, it's important for us to remember that this virus is spread through droplets. Which means that somebody who's got the disease, who coughs or sneezes, can spread those droplets into the environment. They only travel about as far as 2 meters, so they are not airborne. They don't hang in the air. And the way that they're really transmitted is through humans having contact with other humans. For most people who get COVID-19, the illness experience will be fairly mild. So about 80% of people will have a mild illness course, sort of similar to the common cold or the flu, and will be able to manage their symptoms at home. But for a group of people, certainly those who are elderly over the age of 65, or those with chronic health conditions, the risk and the illness can be more severe. So because of that, our population health goals are twofold. One, we really do want to protect those who are most vulnerable and certainly the elderly. And the second is that we are really doing everything we can to protect the healthcare system to ensure that it doesn't get overwhelmed, as we've seen happen in other countries. And so you've likely heard in the media this idea of flattening the curve. So what we are trying to do is decrease the overall total number of people who get COVID-19 in BC, but also stretch that out over a longer period of time so that our healthcare system can handle that extra burden. The way in which we have recommended that everybody band together to achieve these goals. You've heard many, many times from Dr. Henry and Minister Dix in the press. So the number one piece is to really try and minimize the amount of contact, the volume of contact that's happening between humans as just a general high level principle. The best way to reduce the spread of disease is for somebody who's having symptoms of fever, cough, or sneezing to stay away from others whenever possible. So being in their own room, not sharing space with others, that's really the number one way to reduce the spread. The other ways in which we can all help reduce the spread is through physical distancing. So, being 2 meters from people. And this is outside of the household context. So we're talking when we're out in the world. Of course, people in their households or in residential settings, may be difficult or impossible to do that. Hand hygiene, not touching our face, frequent cleaning and disinfection are all things we can do to reduce the chance of the virus getting into us and making us sick and then us spreading it. And then respiratory etiquette, or just this idea that if you are coughing or sneezing, to try and decrease how far those droplets go. And we can do that if we've got a mask available, we could wear that. Homemade masks are showing some effectiveness. They're certainly not as effective as a surgical mask. And not having access to either of those, the next best options would be to cough into a tissue and dispose of it and wash your hands, or cough into your elbow. So we recognize that these are high-level principle population health recommendations, and that they can be challenging to implement in certain settings, and certainly in your settings, that's the case. And so I just want to remind everybody that the overall goal is to limit the contact between humans with the goal of really protecting the healthcare system. So if these measures aren't able to be implemented to the exact letter of the law, that's okay in the overall sort of provincial context. That will probably still be able to flatten the curve, but we do ask people to adhere to them as much as possible. Before I just wrap up my closing remarks, I really do want to acknowledge Ross Chilton and the leadership at CLBC. Ross and I have been in very close contact over the last few weeks, and he's been a wonderful advocate on your behalf. You are definitely not forgotten and not being left behind. This is an extremely challenging time in the health system and beyond. And as a result of that, the Health Emergency Command Center has developed a draft ethical framework for COVID-19. So they've actually brought together 8 or 9 different ethicists to work with clinical experts and develop guidelines and clear, transparent decision-making processes, so that as we are faced with challenging decisions and challenging situations, such as the limited supply of things like masks and gowns and gloves, that there are ethical ways in which to and ethical principles that are guiding the way in which we respond to those shortage in supplies. So I just want to make you aware that that exists and it is guiding the response. And I can speak a little bit more to the personal protective equipment as we go through the questions. Thank you very much, Brenda. I'll end there for now.
Thank you, Danielle. It was really helpful. I'm going to introduce Ross Chilton, CEO from CLBC. Ross tells me he'll be very brief. He texted me, so we'll see how brief Ross can be.
As all of you know, I'm not known for that, so this will be a unique challenge today. But thanks, Brenda, and thanks, Dr. Bean-Smith, and Minister Simpson. I know how busy both of you are, but to free up time yesterday for self-advocates and families and today for providers, really appreciate it. Also thanks Richard Fauché, Ellen Tarshis, and Julie Unger for the information you're going to about to provide. And I also have to say, Brendan Gillette, your CEO, has been in not just daily contact, but I think kind of almost hourly contact at times with me as we try to look at what are the key issues for providers and how we can work together to solve those, everything from first aid to criminal record checks. So you're in good hands with Brenda at the network there. But like all of you, the health and safety of the individuals with developmental disability is our top priority. So it's the health and safety of your employees, the home share providers, and those individuals that's primary in our minds. As we discussed on the call yesterday, we had over 600 self-advocates and families join us to talk about the challenges of COVID-19 and the required changes your agencies have had to make both quickly and significantly to change the way you support individuals. This has required you to redeploy your staff to support individuals in ways that reduce the likelihood that they will become ill or that the staff they support will become ill. This has been challenging for all of you that you operate the over 800 group homes across the province where you provide 24-hour day support. It's also required you to redesign day programs to reduce or eliminate the congregation of supports or to switch from supporting individuals from day programs to supporting them out of or in their homes. As you know, I mean, congregation of anybody at this time, but particularly the people that we support, it's not our friend. And it is not always easy for you to explain or get compliance with the personal distancing or health guidelines, but certainly reducing congregation will help us in reducing transmission risk. I know it's also been very challenging for the 4,000 home share providers that you support, many of whom have had to take on additional responsibilities during the outbreak. I know your coordinators have increased their contact with the home share providers because many of the those providers are under enormous stress during this time. Your employees have had to shift the way they support people. You know, if you look at independent living situations where instead of seeing the person face-to-face, that's needed to be by phone, email, text, and Skype. So we're appreciative of all those changes they've been able to make. It has been almost daily contact, as Dr. Bain-Smith said, with the Provincial Health Office, because it's very important for us to give guidance that's based in public health, and that's what we've been trying to do over the last 2 weeks. We have been inspired to hear how many families and home share providers have been able to take on more responsibility on very short notice, and we hope this has enabled you as providers to direct your attention to the individuals that need that support the most. Not everybody has family in their lives, not everybody has a network in their lives, and those are the people that require most of your attention during this time. It's been impressive to see how the self-advocates have followed the direction to stay home whenever possible. And like all of us, they miss their regular routines, they miss their social contact, and I know that you've done everything you can to keep them socially connected while they're physically distancing. And as you know, we have tremendous respect for your support workers that have come to work every day to provide what is a critical service. Your support workers understand that they're needed. I mean, it's challenging when you get messages, you know, even from our Prime Minister telling people to stay at home, and yet you have asked and your workers have come to work every day to support people. The safety, the health of individuals could not be protected without them taking on those challenges. So over the next number of weeks and months, I'm hoping it's weeks, not months, but we have to be realistic. We're paying close attention to how the situation changes and look at how we can adjust as those changes in terms of how we do business. As Minister Simpson said, we soon hope to be in the position to be able to communicate how recent federal and provincial initiatives will come together to support individuals, families, and home share providers and agencies. And as soon as that information is available, we'll be sharing it with you. So thanks, Brenda.
Thank you, Ross. Appreciate it. I also want to just echo the thanks for CLBC and the staff. I've had so many phone calls with Ross. I can't even count. And I've had several follow-ups with Randy and with Lynn as well. And I'm so appreciative of the help they've given to me as we kind of try to wade our way through what's the best information to share. So I really do appreciate it. Thanks very much. Gentile is now on the line. Gentile from SIA, and I had asked him to be on the call and to share maybe a couple of highlights from the last couple of days that he wants to pass on. And once he's finished, I will move to the agency speakers. So, Gentile. Well, he's clearly not in the speakers. In the speaker's room.
Hi there, Brenda. I can confirm that at the moment I do not see Gentile having dialed in as a speaker. Okay. Therefore, if you'd like, maybe we can have Gentile hit *0 so that we can identify his line, and then we can unmute his line once we know which one it is.
Sure. So let's try that.
Okay, sounds good. So, Gentile, if you can dial *0 for operator assistance, and we will grab your line shortly. Thank you. Just to confirm. Okay, Gentile, I believe your line is now open. Hey, Gentile, your mute button may be on?
No, I'm not. It's not.
Oh, okay. We can hear you now. Thank you.
All righty, then, Gentile Matouz. We had some technical difficulties, and I probably used up half of my allotted time. So I'll try to keep my comments to the essential and to the pragmatic. So in regards to the essential, the last 24 hours have been critical from a perspective that the government under the Emergency Program Act has acted on a number of fronts, not the least of which that's important to the social services sector is the province is now the sole arbiter of what services are essential, and that's an important step to provide clarity. Further to that, the order from the provincial health officer that clearly stipulates that that staff in the social services sector are not to be restricted from employment in health under normal situation is also should provide great relief for social services agencies in regards to what they've been feeling in the last 10 days, where employees were feeling that they had to were being forced to choose between different employers. And that's no longer the case. That's not to say as if the situation changes and the medical health officer issues a further order that it may not change a specific or a broader landscape. But for the time being, it's important to know that you can work both in social services and in health. And that was important information to be communicated. I'm also cognizant of the fact that while we send regular communication to our members, there's a number of agencies who are not members or associates of SIA. At this time, under the current circumstances, I don't think this is the best time for us to continue to live within our legal silos, for lack of better terminology. So what I'm asking my staff to do is that the information that we send to our members also be shared with the broader social services sector as a whole, since we have most of you your contact information, because we've been collecting data from you in the last 3 years. So the focus from SISIA is to provide maybe not a necessarily vast amounts of information, but precise and concrete amounts of information that help you with your day-to-day decision making, and to share it with the entire social services sector in the spirit that we all in this together to try to control the spread of this virus. Again, even if you're not a SOCIA member, if you have questions, please ask us. We'll do our best to answer it. And in addition to it, we'll continue to put out information. There's another bulletin going out in regards to occupational health and safety and obligations under the Work Safe, and more will be coming next week. I want to reassure everyone that SOCIA is working in close relationship with the CEO network, with CLBC, with the Federation, and the different government agencies to ensure that we're consistent in our approach and we give you the most up-to-date information as the situation is fluid.
Thank you, Gentile. Okay, thanks, Gentile. Gentile and I phone each other more than once a day, I would say, on average, multiple times a day, but we've now developed a rather cryptic texting shorthand, so we're not taking up as much of each other's time. I have appreciated the support he's given me, especially with some of the thornier issues that I receive from members. I also want to assure everybody that anything that Gentile puts out, I know they are trying to send it out to the non-union agencies. I also distribute it to all members, and everything that I distribute is on our website. So if you've missed something, it will be there, and you can read it. So now I'm going to move to the speakers. I'm going to start with Richard. Richard, I think we're done this call in 25 minutes roughly, so we're going to try to restrict your comments, not because I want to, but I'm going to try to keep it to about 4 minutes, so it's between the 3 and 5. So yeah, Richard Fauché is the co-CEO for the Burnaby Association for Community Inclusion. Off you go, Richard.
Thank you, Brenda, and thanks to Ross and Minister Simpson and Dr. Smith and Gentile for the information. I got 3 minutes here. First, I just want to say I'm thinking of all of you out in the field trying to react and respond to this crazy situation. So I think we're all in this together, and I just want to say that if any of you after the meeting wants to reach out, you have my email, and please do so. For us at Bauchi, it's been all about mitigating the situation since the beginning of March. It didn't take us very long to realize that some of the protocol around social distancing would be difficult to implement with a population of folks that struggle on a good day and the fact that people want to be close. So we begin to coordinate our effort within our association. We established 3 teams immediately, and then we started to reach out. So we had a team that was focusing on advocacy around the things that we need to make sure of, such as, you know, connecting to hospital, coming places, city. Then we formed a team around outreach that began to design service delivery systems, supply request, designing activity kits for folks once they're in their homes. And so if you want some information around this stuff, we could send you the model of the kind of kits, and they're happening. We've delivered 300 kits over the past 3 days into families' homes and staff-supported homes and places where we know it's tough these days and they need some out. We also did a website, and I'll put a plug in because it's called comakedo.ca. Please go on it. There'll be some activities. We're creating content on the internet, so we're trying to address social isolation at the same time as try to mitigate the risk for infection. And then we reach out to our, and in terms of service delivery, we've obviously reallocated all our support. All our homes are in have been designed with stations in them. to disinfect stations, to isolate. We have also worked really hard with our staff. A lot of the homes and some of the staff have taken people home, so we've tried really hard to limit the number of people in those homes and the coming and going out of the homes. So we've set up all kind of arrangement these days so that we seal this up and people are not going out, and our delivery system that we've got set up is delivering groceries, is delivering. So we're trying to keep a very, very close eye on the number of people going in and out. And as a result of reallocating our resource, we've created a pool of new workers as well that have been now reoriented and working in some places. And so far, so good. The staff at Bocce have stepped up, and we're working closely. So I could go on and on about things, but I think that all of you also have a good number of ideas and the things you're doing. And I think what I would like to say, and what I would like to say to CLBC, is that we need to find a way to better coordinate our efforts as a sector. And I feel that there's a lot of ingenuity in our sector, and it's always been there. And right now, I think we're going in all directions, and I think we would be better off if we could find a way to coordinate this. So, look, we're thinking of you. We're in the same boat. We have all kind of ideas. We're doing stuff. Like, we had a connections with a 3D printing company today that we think will be about to start doing these face masks. We're all in this together, and if we could connect the dots with each other, I think we'll be better off. And So please feel free to reach out, and I think together we're stronger. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard. Really appreciate the time you took to come on the call and share your thoughts. I will share the CEO Network speakers' email addresses with their permission in tonight's bulletin, so that if people have specific questions, not to inundate folks, but if they have specific questions, they can reach out. So secondly, I'm going to introduce Ellen Tarshis from Community Living Victoria. Ellen and I exchanged email this morning, kind of trying to decide, I think, in some respects, whose job was harder, mine or the leader of an agency. And I have to say that I think my job is easier. I am not dealing with the day-to-day issues of redeployment and creating safe spaces for individuals and families, nor creating a reasonable work environment for employees and keeping their morale up. So here's Ellen.
Thank you, Brenda, and thank you. And good morning. I echo Richard's comments. One of the things that has helped me through is the sharing of resources, the support from my colleagues, the direct support from some other agencies. So I thank them all for that, and hope that we are stronger together. We've had two goals at Community Living Victoria. That is to keep our supported individuals and families as safe and healthy as possible, and to keep our employees as safe and healthy as possible. Those goals have guided every decision we have made as a leadership team. I can't emphasize enough how important it has been to thank our staff with every opportunity and in multiple ways. At CLV, we made the call early that individuals we support would not attend our community inclusion programs or other organizations' community inclusion programs. This was not only done for safety for them, but also to lead and show our employees that we are being proactive and to build confidence in our leadership during this crisis. We've redeployed all our CI staff to our homes to provide some extra support and ensure, and we have arranged for the delivery of smaller, scaled down, more contained services. We have checked in regularly with our community inclusion folks and families to ensure they have support and in some cases have provided it in their homes or provided additional funds for them to arrange their own supports. We've arranged for routine professional cleaning of our homes and our community inclusion programs, spaces, and use the empty spaces for scheduled outings for people we support in our homes when they need a break. Virtual meetings are held daily with directors, weekly with supervisors, and memos to the frontline staff, as I'm sure you all are, to keep them up to date. Labor management meetings, DOSH meetings by Zoom to keep connected and aligned with the union. We've also augmented our on-call system with two managers and created a buddy system for the weekend. We've created a matrix to support them so that we can ensure consistency in our responses to our staff. We in our host agency have scaled back some supports. Contractors are developing, you know, meeting with people electronically when face-to-face isn't possible or necessary. In HomeShare, regular check-ins, providing information as it comes in, offering additional funds when needed. In one case, we connected a HomeShare provider with some behavioral support in order to support them with an individual who's having difficulty with self-isolating. In our family support, we've been calling families who need it the most, typically with very challenging children or adults still at home with no support. They're dropping off hampers and supplies to them if they can't get out or source things. They're talking to them. We put out, you know, activity packages together for parents who have young children. As Ross said, you mentioned the independent living folks. This is a group we are very concerned about, as they live on their own with limited weekly supports. They're often the most vulnerable from both poverty and isolation. Some are having great difficulty following social distancing guidelines. Often their home is not being regularly sanitized. For this group of people, we've moved to same thing, daily conversation on phone, on Facebook, Google Duo as well. That reduces their isolation, but we also have a very set script that we follow in terms of ensuring that they are feeling well and showing no symptoms at all, no symptoms of COVID-19. It also is an opportunity to provide daily reminders. We're able to deal with urgent things like groceries, medical needs, finances. And with our CI programs closed, the staff have a van that they can use, and as well as we've sent additional vans to our home, and in one case allowed an employee to use one of our vans instead of using public transit. That's what he needed to be comfortable to come to work. We've helped them to download the BC Thrive COVID app as well for our independent folks. We, in our apartment living support program, where people have higher needs and get regular help with cooking and shopping, for example, we're doing some of that. We're reducing the number of outings. We're buying groceries for them, doing some mass cooking and delivering homemade frozen meals to their doors. We've set up a pantry of sorts in one of our offices so that as staff are going out to see families and individuals, they can take extra non-perishable supplies. This has come from staff as well as friends and board members. We're finding the community really wants to help. And again, just finally, the fact that we share resources with other agencies and have support has meant the world to us, and together we will get through this. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. It's amazing how much information somebody can share in 5 minutes, truly. Thank you so much. Now we'll move along to Julie. Julie's the Executive Director for the Chilliwack Society for Community Living.
Thanks, Brenda. Hi to everybody out there, all of our fellow community living agency leaders, Minister Simpson, Dr. Smith, Mr. Chilton, for being formal. First, I'd just like to express my gratitude to each of you on behalf of our organization, the individuals and families that we support, for your leadership during these challenging times. It's a daunting task, to say the least, and we are grateful for strong leaders in our province. So thank you so much. Reporting today on some of the strategies being used here at CSCL, there's a lot of fears out there. Probably the biggest one right now is in regards to PPE, and people are, we've actually noticed an increase in the use of it, and so we immediately provide some additional education for our employees about the appropriate times for them to be using those supplies. Relias has some great online training. There's some free training that's available for agencies that haven't signed up to use it. They have made free training available. And just about appropriate use of PPE. Further to that, we've created our own sort of central distribution within the organization, so where we're keeping an inventory of it, and then we've got a request process in place to be able to distribute that as it's required. Additionally, our outreach team working with self-advocates and community has created some emergency packs, which include some pre-made, easy-to-warm meals, some first aid supplies, some comfort items, and they're distributing in those and have them available for individuals. Earlier this month, we began a process whereby each of our community inclusion service managers made contact with every family and individual using our services to determine the level of support that they were going to need going forward. Some families and caregivers had already opted to keep individuals at home. Others had indicated they'd be fine with minimal or limited support, and not surprising to us, some let us know they were going to need ongoing support. So based on these reports, together with our assessments, we devised a support plan to significantly reduce, reconfigure our larger CI services to just the most critical support needs. We recognized that in the absence of any of those services, we would be creating other crises in our community and for those folks and their families, and we didn't want that to happen. So of those being supported, no more than two or three people being supported at a time. Most supports are one-to-one. They're occurring in a variety of our CSCL-owned or rented facilities. One of the challenges with potentially providing in-home supports to families or caregivers is really the lack of control we then have over that environment for our employees and the potential increased risk to their health and safety. So we felt that with our community-based CI facilities, program spaces being essentially vacated, we had greater opportunity to encourage social distancing for folks. And then with increased daily cleaning and disinfecting, we could ensure a safer work environment for everybody. Our managers are making weekly calls to the families and caregivers of individuals we're not currently supporting, just checking in, making sure that things are going okay, so that we can inject some supports if necessary before their situation might become critical. And in addition, our leadership team is connecting with managers every morning to learn of any issues that might be bubbling up and being able to adjust our organizational response quickly. Given adjusted work schedules, reconfigured community inclusion services, we had then a number of employees we could redeploy. The first few days, they were reassigned to extensive cleaning, disinfecting of facilities and vehicles. We seconded one of our managers into the role of full-time scheduler for the organization. So she's looking across the organization at any staffing gaps. Surprisingly, our recruitment issues didn't go away during this COVID pandemic. So we have unfilled vacancies, employees on leave, and so she was looking at those and filling those first, and then in consultation with other service managers began redeploying and assigning staff, residential services, small group and individual supports and community inclusion services. We've done something similar with our child and youth services. Obviously, that was done in consultation with MCFD. We've learned that our EAs are being called back to work next week into the schools. We're not sure exactly what that's going to look like, but it will have an impact because we have caregivers who are also EAs. And so those caregivers who have been able to keep people home during spring break, their ability to continue to do that might be affected in the coming weeks. In regards to contracted services, our respite, particularly some respite caregivers are continuing to provide care. Again, we've gone through a process where we've identified the most critical needs. and that in the absence of those supports, there would be crises or breakdown of placements. And so we're also offering our community inclusion spaces for some of those supports to happen if they're not happening in people's homes. Our PBS coordinator, we have an internal positive behavior supports coordinator. He's created some video instruction that he's offered out to our teams just about maintaining routine for people, setting up daily calendars, controlling those pieces that people can control and creating some stability and predictability in people's days. And he's also offered his services via video conferencing to any of our teams and individuals that need some support to adjust positive behavior support plans. We've developed a COVID-19 exposure tracking list, is what we're calling it, in our online database, and so we're using that for employees, caregivers, individuals served. Managers are populating that list daily based on any absence for our services, so whether an individual or their family are choosing not to participate from a cautionary perspective or if they've been asked to stay at home based on doing the self-assessment. We're tracking all of that. We're able to do a daily roll-up of that data, and if necessary, down the road, quickly track and filter the information according to a variety of categories so that we'll be able to hopefully mitigate any further exposure. We're doing daily communication with our staff, so that's in the form of a daily alert on our intranet, our ShareVision system. And I went out on a limb yesterday and created a video on YouTube. My kids told me I'm the lamest YouTuber ever. However, I did hear back from many of our employees how appreciative they were of that, and so it's something I'll use going forward as well. I think in the absence of face-to-face meetings, being able to see a video or to have some messaging that's different than emails or written form has proven useful to our employees. And again, like everybody else, I'm super thankful for all the shared resources from all of the other organizations across the province. And, you know, we're just facing this day by day and recognizing that we have some amazing employees who are stepping up every day to do what's asked. I have not heard a single complaint from our employees, and just so proud to work with these people in community. And I know that we will continue to adjust our response as is necessary going forward. So thanks to all of you as well.
Thank you, Julie. So we had, there's been a lot of information shared. Remember, it's recorded, so you will be able by Monday, I think, to be listening to this and grabbing out some of the detail that you can then use for yourselves. So we're going to move into questions. There were a number of questions submitted. I just want to let you know before we do that we do have until 12:30. The line will be open until 12:30. So we'll still have to rush while we will still, pardon me, have to rush through the questions. We don't have to be done in 6 minutes. I believe that it's now 12:09. So we've got about 20 minutes. So the first question is for Minister Simpson. Minister, can you outline what specific mechanisms are in place today to protect BC's most vulnerable, and specifically people with disabilities in our community, and ensure that their civil liberties are being acknowledged?
Thanks for that. And I guess a couple of things. One is, I think there are two issues there. The one regarding civil liberties and all of that, we're very much looking to protect that, and certainly the expectation is there are limits, obviously, on everybody's civil liberties across the board in the province in order to fight this virus and fight COVID-19, and we will continue to put those forward, and they come through the Emergency Measures Act and the orders of the provincial health officer, and so persons with disabilities will be captured as everybody else is by those limits to make sure that we're being as effective as we can as we take COVID-19 on. But the other thing I would note is that the structures are still in place. The Human Rights Commissioner that was put in place by the government continues to be there. If somebody believes that there are very challenging issues around civil liberties, we're looking at continuing, you know, we've been through the Reimagining Community Inclusion process, and we're just ramping up the implementation and the steering committee and that to move forward on those issues when all of this hit us. But we'll be looking at being able to use that committee that brings representation from across the sector together to make sure we have a touchstone moving forward. And Ross and my deputy in that will be very engaged in that process moving forward. We're looking, as with everybody, to make sure we're supporting our most vulnerable citizens in terms of resources in that. We'll certainly have more to say next week, including supports for CLBC that will flow through in some cases to you and some cases directly to people who are living with disability and their loved ones. But I'm not sure what else to say other than we're looking to protect people's rights within the context of making sure we fight this this virus as effectively as we can.
Thank you, Minister. So my second question is directed to both Ross and Dr. Bain-Smith. The question is, why has CLBC directed service providers with staffed residences to deploy staff to family homes if someone returns home during this emergency? Does that not increase the risk of getting COVID-19 for the individual, their family, and for service provider staff?
Thanks, Brenda. And one of the things we put out this week was that because we know some families are going to be worried and wish to take their family member home, and in many cases when they do so, that will free up some of the agency capacity to respond to other individuals' needs. But we also wanted to be clear that when a situation where there's a breakout in a group home and somebody's infected, the individual will not be able to be removed at that point because of just the concern expressed there. Really what we're trying to do, and I've heard through all the comments from Julie, Richard, and from Ellen, is that you have been working hard to reduce congregation and people coming into contact with more people. And so what we directed was that, you know, if there's families that can take their individual home to be with them and they need support from you as an agency and you're able to provide that, that you do it so that it makes that situation manageable. And again, takes care of that person's interests, but also the safety of your staff.
Thanks, Ross. Dr. Bain-Smith, can you speak to the part of this question about the safety risk of support workers going into personal homes?
Yes, thank you. So I think that what Ross is just speaking to is that we recognize that really in this crisis, there is a need to balance risks. So the risk of spreading the virus needs to be balanced against the risk of services not being provided or not being available. So really when it comes to assessing safety, we really need to be thinking about balancing those two risks. Going back to the very beginning opening remarks, the things that we can do to reduce the spread of the virus, especially in this context, is to observe really good hand hygiene and for the staff to stay away if they're having symptoms. That's a really key point that I don't think I emphasized in my opening remarks, is that what we know so far in terms of how this virus is spread is that people are at their most contagious when they develop symptoms. So during that incubation period where they may have been exposed but haven't yet developed symptoms, their risk of spreading the virus actually appears to be quite low. So in this sense, the risk to family and individuals would be greatest if a service provider was coming in with symptoms. So we would encourage people to go in if they're having symptoms, but stay away from others. And really, we just need to be thinking about how do we balance these complex risks. Thanks.
Thank you. The next question, I'm actually going to skip the next question and return to it if we have time, but I'm going to go to the following one, which says, there are concerns being expressed in the disability community that the value of life of a person with a disability may be considered secondary to that of an able-bodied individual. What can you say to alleviate these fears? And this question would be for Minister Simpson and Dr. Smith.
Well, thank you, and I very much appreciate the level of anxiety and fear and concern in the community that there is. But what I would say is this fear in terms of anybody being treated as a second-class citizen is unwarranted. The commitment of government is to support everybody The decisions that are made are decisions that I know people in your organizations, people at CLBC, people in government, are not going to view persons with disabilities as second-class citizens. Dr. Smith can talk more to this, but, you know, I think one of the critical things that she spoke a little bit to earlier is the team of medical ethicists that have been put in place so that those decisions, medical decisions about choices that need to be made on the medical in medical terms will be done with that ethical lens to ensure that that's happening. I just want to encourage people to very much, if you hear these kind of concerns, if there's any substance behind the concern, feed it back through CLBC, feed it back to my office. I don't want to hear them, but I'm welcome them if they're legitimate. In terms other than that, I would ask you to do what you can do to diminish those fears. They are not helpful. They're not warranted. That is not the view of government or the medical community. And we're not helping anybody if those kind of fears start to run. Be assured, it's not the position of the government is we are going to treat everybody as well as we can, and we are going to treat our most vulnerable and most exposed citizens with extra care and attention to make sure that they get through this as well as they can.
Minister, mm-hmm. Minister, it's David Galbraith. Can I make one comment?
Sure.
Just want to tell the group also – I co-chair, there's a vulnerable population working group that comprises all the health authorities and all the social sector ministries. And its whole purpose is ensuring that as we go through this this emergency, that we don't lose sight of the vulnerable populations of BC. And that's one of the functions. So we make sure we talk about a number of these issues, and we meet twice a week, and then we feed into the provincial emergency coordination unit. So there is a voice, and it's a strong voice, and it has all of the right people that need to be there to be ensuring that vulnerable populations aren't left behind. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both Minister Simpson and to David Galbraith for those comments. Dr. Smith, have you got anything you could follow up with?
Sure, thank you. I would just echo and give thanks to Minister Simpson and David Galbraith for their comments, and I would support those. I think that, you know, again, our population health goals are to protect those at risk of the most severe COVID-19 disease, so the elderly and folks with chronic health conditions, and to flatten the curve and protect our healthcare system. We're hoping that by taking action to reach both of those goals that we can avoid the need to make those really ethically challenging decisions. However, I would say and just really flag for you and make very transparent that work is underway. The ethical framework that I described has been developed by 8 or 9 different ethicists, and every health authority has ethicists on call as part of their health authority emergency operating centers to guide any challenging decisions that may need to be made as this epidemic continues, to make sure that they are abiding the principles of fairness and inclusion and accountability and transparency. So I just really wanted to again make that very clear that in no way are people with disabilities regarded as being less important or less worthy of resources and support through this crisis, and that there are pieces in place to ensure that any decisions that are made now and into the future are guided by ethical principles. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm kind of moving through the questions that were sent in and that I was provided with to look at what are likely some of the most important, as I understand it, from our sector. So I'm going to move to the personal protection equipment question. What personal protection equipment measures do you have in place for care aides? What protocol and guidelines have been set and communicated to staff about monitoring the health and safety of individuals? So that was was for Dr. Bain-Smith and for Ross as well.
Great. Thank you so much, Brenda. So there's a couple of things that I'll say on this. So the first thing I'll say is I'll acknowledge that personal protection equipment such as masks, gloves, and gowns are in short supply around the world. There are efforts in the province and a working group that are working to consolidate a whole of province review and procurement process to streamline and get the chain of supply to BC happening in a consistent and reliable way. And the ethical framework that I was just referring to has actually guided the development of a document known as the PPE allocation framework, so that the way in which limited PPE might be distributed is done in an ethical way. So I just want people to know that that work is happening in the background. In addition to that, we're working on a specific guideline document for people who are working in social service settings that don't fall under the umbrella of formal healthcare settings, but in which some of the contact and some of the activities may be quite similar to what they might experience in a healthcare setting. So that document is just in the stages of final review, and we anticipate that it will be out shortly. What I would say on the issue of reducing the spread of the virus, it's important to remember that this virus is spread through droplets. And so in routine environments where there is nobody that's actively ill with coughing or sneezing, that the risk of transmission is quite low, risk of spreading the virus is low because there are, very few infected droplets in the environment if somebody isn't coughing or sneezing. So in that circumstance, the things that we've listed before, physical distancing, hand hygiene, not touching your face, and frequent cleaning and disinfection, that is really what is required. And you do not need supplies that go above and beyond regular cleaning supplies. Where things get a little bit more challenging and where this document that I was referring to, this guideline for social service settings, is hopefully going to provide a little bit more clarity is in the circumstance that there is somebody who is has symptoms and we're still in mild symptoms that are able to be cared for at home, and how do we then reduce the risk of spreading the virus if the different personal protective equipment is in short supply. So that document will go through and give people suggestions based on the best available science in terms of what you can do in those scenarios where there may be infected droplets in the environment, but you may not have access to, for example, a surgical mask. Just back to that previous point about ethical considerations, again, all of the distribution of limited scarce resources is being guided by the ethical framework. And I just want to reassure you that, again, with Ross Chilton's really excellent advocacy and my pushing that up the chain, everybody is aware of the challenging and unique situations that you are in and the close proximity and the nature of your contact. And so you are being regarded as very high priority in terms of that chain of allocation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, I'm looking at who our audience is, and I know that the medical and care questions are paramount, but I also know that I continuously hear the question about contracts, how will not providing full services right now affect contracts and having to reimburse CLBC in the future. We will all have admin expenses and direct worker expenses. That question's for Ross.
Yeah, thanks, Brenda. And absolutely, there's going to be a lot of sorting out to do once this crisis has passed. And really what I would say is that, I trust that in the future when our staff can sit down with your staff to review what you did, what additional costs you had, how you redeployed people, that reasonability on both sides is going to come to that conversation, and that we'll end up in a place that's satisfactory to both the providers and to us in terms of accountability for taxpayer dollars. So I have full confidence those conversations will go well. Just keep track, of course, of what you're doing.
Thank you, Ross. I am looking at the rest of these questions, and I guess another important one for people on the line is going to be, why are we not completely shutting staffed residential homes down? I mean, this is not shutting them down and sending people somewhere else, but it's to close it to visitors. So long-term care did that 2 weeks ago, and just wondering, the question is just wondering why or when that should occur.
Okay. Maybe I can take that on, Brenda.
Sure.
The challenge in our sector is those 2,500 individuals that are in the staffed homes. That's what they are. They are all individuals. So their unique needs and circumstances really vary. And we know that the providers and your staff that know these individuals, know their families very well, are in the best place to kind of make important decisions. Of course, ideally, the situation would be that there's as few people entering into the home as possible, and that would include restricting family members from visiting and encouraging them to stay connected through phone or through Skype, those kinds of technology solutions. But we also know that there's some individuals that if they were suddenly to have no access to their family member, they could become very stressed and even more challenging to support and to keep safe. So what we're trusting is your agencies are managing those exposures to risk in the best way possible, and that you will limit the number of people having access to the home without me coming down with a general edict from CLBC telling you what to do, when we know that you know what to do and that there are so many unique circumstances that you need to take into consideration in what you do.
Thanks, Ross. I think we have time for like 1 minute for one other very brief question, and this is one that I hear every day multiple times. Much of the focus that we're hearing is on community care, and it's on facilities in BC, but there's no specific direction or policy with respect to the community living care environment. It leads to a lot of confusion and uncertainty from the disability community. When will or will government provide such a response and directive? And I guess this question is both for Dr. Smith and Ross, but we've only got about a minute, if that.
Sure. Thank you, Brenda. I'll be very brief. I'm hoping that the document that I was referencing earlier that speaks to reducing virus transmission in social service settings, will help to fill some of that gap and provide a bit more direction. So maybe I'll just leave it at that and pass it to Ross.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Ross, do you...
It's been an amazing time, and just the incredible access to the provincial health office through Dr. Bain Smith. You know, we have been emailing each other early in the morning, late at night, really trying to make sure that the messaging gets out, fits for the reality of the circumstances you're sharing. And you know, when I listened to to Alan, Julie, and Richard talk today, what I heard was situations that are different in each of your organizations, but the amazing things that you have done. So there will be that interim guidance comes out, but that will not replace in any way the incredible decisions and important decisions that you're making day to day in terms of keeping people safe, keeping your staff safe, and helping us get through this crisis. So there'll be the guidance, but I think that doing as you've done right now today is shared with each other, continuing to share with each other. I think that's where the best kind of solutions are going to be out there.
Okay, with that, we're going to conclude. Our time is up. I want to thank everybody who participated on this call, speakers and the audience who's listening. I do want to thank again CLBC. This call was kind of a brainchild that occurred to me after the CEO Network's members conference call last Friday, and Ross kind of picked it up from there, and together we were able to put it together. But really, a lot of thanks and kudos to Randy for coordinating this for us all. So I wish you all a good and safe weekend. Stay healthy, and I'm sure I'll be talking to many of you over the upcoming days. Thank you all.
Thank you, Brenda. Bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the Caring for People During COVID-19 conference call. Thank you for your participation and have a nice day.